This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sacha Baron Cohen, is up for 3 Golden Globes for Best Actor and Best Picture for his Borat sequel and Best Supporting Actor in The Trial of the Chicago 7. It's only the 4th time anyone's gotten so many nominations in one season. We recorded this edition of our show before the Globe Awards ceremony Sunday night. He also has 2 Screen Actors Guild nominations for The Trial of the Chicago 7 as Best Supporting Actor and as part of the Best Cast in a Movie. Sacha Baron Cohen is famous for creating characters and playing them in the real world, interacting with real people who have no idea the character isn't real, it's just a fictional character. In his new film titled Borat, subsequent movie film, which is streaming on Amazon, Baron Cohen returns to his character Borat, a journalist from Kazakhstan who's kind of an idiot and believes conspiracy theories and anti-Semitic tropes. In the sequel, he returns to America. We'll talk later about that film and what happened behind the scenes, including a now infamous scene in a hotel bedroom with Rudy Giuliani. In the Netflix film, The Trial of the Chicago 7, written and directed by Aaron Sorkin, Baron Cohen plays Yippie leader Abby Hoffman, one of the organizers of the Vietnam War protests in Chicago during the 1968 Democratic National Convention. The police met protesters with billy clubs and tear gas, leading to violent confrontations. The Nixon administration charged activists, including Hoffman, with crossing state lines and conspiring to riot. Hoffman was a countercultural radical who used humor, absurdity, and theatrics. Even when he was testifying during the Chicago 7 trial, he was irreverent. In this scene, he's on the stand and is questioned first by Judge Julius Hoffman and then by his defense attorney, William Kunstler. Kunstler is played by Mark Rylance, Judge Hoffman by Frank Langella.
Would you state your full name for the record, please?
It's Abby.
Last name.
My grandfather's name was Shaboysnikov, but he was a Russian Jew protesting anti-Semitism, so he was assigned a name that would sound like yours.
What is your date of birth?
Psychologically, 1960.
What were you doing until 1960?
Nothing. I believe it's called an American education.
Why don't we just proceed with the testimony?
Sure. Abby, do you know why you're on trial here?
We carried certain ideas across state lines. Not machine guns or drugs or little girls, ideas. When we crossed from New York to New Jersey to Pennsylvania to Ohio to Illinois, we had certain ideas. And for that, we were gassed, beaten, arrested, and put on trial.
Okay.
In 1861, Lincoln said in his inaugural address, "When the people shall grow weary of their constitutional right to amend their government, they shall exert their revolutionary right to dismember and overthrow that government." And if Lincoln had given that speech in Lincoln Park last summer, he'd be put on trial with the rest of us.
So how do you overthrow or dismember, as you say, your government peacefully?
In this country, we do it every 4 years.
Sacha Baron Cohen, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Terry, for having me back.
How did having played Abby Hoffman when he was being tried for crossing state lines and conspiring to riot affect how you saw the January 6th insurrection? And you know the shaman guy, the QAnon shaman? The guy with the bare chest and the face paint and the horns? How did you see him? Did you see him as some kind of bizarre theater or as somebody who had like a serious mental health problem or what? I'm just like, from your point of view, who does all this kind of like taking theater into the real world, like, what do you make of him?
Well, it seemed bizarre firstly that Borat wasn't next to him. Yeah. I mean, we had a chat, all the writers got together after that happened, and we said, listen, if we were still filming, we probably would have been there. But the whole basis of QAnon is so completely bonkers that in a way he's a perfect visual representation of those who believe in this bizarre conspiracy theory of pedophilic, cannibalistic cabal of certain politicians and Hollywood celebrities. So I thought he was the perfect representation of what QAnon is, which is this completely loopy ideology that has become mass through social media.
And I'm sure you were struck by T-shirts like 6 million not enough in Camp Auschwitz. I know you're very much involved with fighting anti-Semitism and with Holocaust awareness.
Yeah, well, I mean, on the plus side, at least those people believed that the Holocaust existed. What I'd been trying to work on was that Holocaust denialism online had been helped a lot by Facebook and YouTube and Google. So, yes, I wasn't very happy to read those requests for a more thorough genocide next time. However, at least they believed that the Holocaust existed, which a large proportion of the world don't.
So before we talk about the Borat film, I want to talk about the trial of the Chicago 7. You know, I thought you were so perfectly cast as Abbie Hoffman because in totally different ways, like you've turned the world into your stage by bringing your characters into the world, just as like Abbie Hoffman in his own different way really was practicing a form of street theater a lot of the time. Do you see it that way?
Well, firstly about him, he was very aware of the stage and of the cameras and that he was creating a persona and, you know, performing actions in order to get young people motivated. So he knew that, you know, he could use humor to firstly challenge systemic racism and the establishment. But he also knew that if he was funny and brilliant, which he was, he would be able to get sort of young people to sacrifice their lives to fight against the Vietnam War. You know, he was influenced by the idea of taking theater into the streets, and he was very, very thoughtful. So he was going on stand-up tours during the trial. But they felt very off the cuff. However, they were extremely prepared. And he had studied Lenny Bruce, studied the rhythms, and also learned some other lessons from Lenny Bruce, including that the trial was a show trial and that they would be convicted. So, yes, I think he was very aware of that. He was influenced by certain theatrical movements at the time. And he was aware that they didn't have any money. You know, the Yippies didn't have any money. And the way that he could actually make an impact was by being funny, by doing these seemingly crazy things like getting thousands of students to try and levitate the Pentagon or nominating a pig to run for leader of the Democratic Party. You know, the more I read about him, I did see some similarity.
Between you and him?
To a degree. I mean, he was ready to die for his cause.
You've almost died for yours. Inadvertently.
Yeah. That's accidental. I mean,
you've broken bones to make your movies. You've been chased by police. You've been sued. You've taken a lot of risks, including risks you swore you wouldn't take again, and you just took them again.
Yes. I mean, we can get onto that, but that...
We'll get onto that later, yeah.
I can tell you why I returned to the madness.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a little while. Just to get to something like less profound than what we've been talking about, less deep, it's just like your voice in it. Like instead of saying like park, you'll say pock. And I was trying to like place the accent because I think Abbie Hoffman's from New York.
No, he's from Boston.
No wonder, because it always sounded like really Boston to me. Because New Yorkers like me have a real hard R, like park, you know?
Yes, yes, yeah. He's from Massachusetts. So his accent is actually a little bit complex because it's Boston mixed with a little bit from sort of Brandeis and Berkeley, where he was educated. And then at times he jumps an octave. You know, when he's speaking to the crowd, he gets very excited and he would almost sound like a Jewish shrieking grandmother. You know, it's a really, really complex accent, and I was terrified about it.
So you initially got the role as Abbie Hoffman years ago when Steven Spielberg was going to be directing it. Then it kind of sat in limbo for a while, and then Aaron Sorkin took over directing the film and rewriting it, I guess. And he kept you in that role, even though you were more than a decade older than you were when you first got it. How did Spielberg cast you? Did he just think, like, I know who'd be perfect for this, and it was you? Or did he ask you to audition?
No, it was the opposite. Basically, I heard that there was going to be a movie about the Chicago 7. I was kind of obsessed with Abbie Hoffman from the age of 20. And with great chutzpah, I called up Steven Spielberg and I said, can you let me audition? And he had some reservations, particularly about the accent, because he knew it was a very specific accent. And he sent me a dialect coach. And together, the dialect coach, every night, we recorded three versions of a speech. And after 2 weeks, Spielberg said, okay, I need the version of that speech that you're happy with, deliver it to my house at 9 a.m. So I had, you know, I'd recorded about 30 versions. The dialect coach said, take 28. And I instructed my assistant, I said, put take 28 on a CD, deliver it to Mr. Spielberg's house. I meet up with Steven at lunchtime at the Milky Way, which was his mother's kosher restaurant on Pico. And he sits me down and he says, listen, Sasha, I've got to be honest. I got the CD, thank you. The first 10 or so takes were not very good at all. And I realized my assistant had given the wrong CD. He'd listened to all 28. And he said, by the end, Sasha, it was perfect. But, you know, I mean, by the way, that is why Spielberg is Spielberg. And why a lot of those people are who they are. They've got incredible talent. But they sit through till take 28 when they should have switched off after take 4.
Okay, so let's talk about your Borat subsequent movie film. And, you know, you'd been sued and nearly killed. You suffered broken bones for your work in character in other films, including your first Borat film. Why did you decide to do it again? I mean, you're lucky to have gotten out alive from those films.
I think the answer is Donald Trump. I remember the Muslim ban and friends sending me articles. And at that point, I think I was just so angry that I felt I had to do something other than forward articles from the New York Times and Washington Post. It was the midterms, and I had assumed that Borat was impossible to revive. However, Jimmy Kimmel invited me on, and I did a tiny skit as Borat with real people. And the next day, I just sat with my two writers in the room, Anthony Hines and Dan Swyman. I said, hold on, is there a movie in Borat that we can make that could possibly influence the election? And we came up with this concept. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm a writer and a comedian. I didn't think I'd have a large impact at all. But we felt we had to do something. We felt that democracy was in real danger. You know, I was terrified that if Trump got in again, that America would be a democracy in name only. It would be similar to the democracy you see in Turkey or in Russia. I felt very clearly from the start of the last administration that we were heading towards authoritarianism. And so I felt I had to do something.
So I want to talk about the premise of the film. Let's start with a clip. The movie opens. I should explain, Borat is a journalist from Kazakhstan who in the past has made trips to the U.S. and misinterpreted everything he hears. And as I mentioned earlier, he's a total anti-Semite. He thinks women are there to serve men. He believes in a lot of conspiracy theories. So when the film opens, he's actually on a chain gang in Kazakhstan being punished for ruining Kazakhstan's reputation in the U.S. And I'm going to pick it up with some of your opening narration from the beginning of the film.
14 years ago, I released a movie film which was great success in USA. But Kazakhstan became a laughingstock around the world. I was blamed for Kazakhstan's failure and banned from ever make reportings again. I was sentenced for life to hard labor in Gulag. But 14 years later, men from government bring me to presidential palace.
Premier Nazarbayev.
Ascultă-mă bine, tâmpitule. USSR a fost distrusă de un om rău.
He explained that while I was in Gulag, USNA was ruined by an evil man who stood against all American values. His name? Barack Obama. This led to other Africans becoming political leaders. But then a miracle occurred. A magnificent new premier named McDonald Trump rose to power and made America great again. He also became buddies with tough guy leaders across the world. Putin, Kim Jong-un, Bolsonaro, and Kanye West.
So that's the opening clip, the voiceover narration from the new Borat movie. And Sacha Baron Cohen, take it from here. Describe the setup and how Mike Pence enters the picture.
Okay, so Premier Nazarbayev, our version of Premier Nazarbayev, obviously our whole Kazakhstan is completely mythical, but Premier Nazarbayev wants to get into the club of authoritarian leaders that Trump has set up. And, you know, that came about because obviously Trump became friendly with a bunch of these dictators around the world. Premier Nazarbayev wants to get into it. He tells Borat that the way to get into that is to give a bribe to Vice President Pence. That bribe is somebody called Johnny the Monkey, who's their Minister of Culture. And when Borat gets to America, he finds out that the monkey is dead. And in the crate with the monkey is his 15-year-old daughter,
who's stowed aboard. And he decides to, Borat decides to make his daughter the gift to Pence because he knows that Pence is such a famous ladies' man that he can't be alone in the room with a woman, which I thought was hilarious.
He cannot be left alone in the room with a woman. And it's after seeing, he doesn't know what to give as a gift, and he sees a shot of Epstein and Trump on the TV and realizes that the Trump government love young girls, and he's there with a 15-year-old girl. So Premier Nazarbayev says, yeah, how old is she? 15. Perfect marriage age. And then, yeah, he decides to give her to Mike Pence, and she's extremely happy. It's like a kind of Disney story for her. She's going to live the dream and become the new Melania.
So let's talk about like the most famous or infamous scene from the film. At some point, the attempt to give her to Mike Pence fails. So now she's going to be offered to Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani. And the setup is she's posing as a reporter for a right-wing journalism group called Patriots Report. She's going to interview him in a hotel room. So let's start with how did you get, to the extent that you can tell us, how did you get Rudy Giuliani to agree to this? My understanding is that you have really long, complicated release forms that people have to sign. And a lot of people probably sign them without representation and don't read all of it. But Rudy Giuliani is a lawyer. Can you tell us how you got him to agree to do this interview with somebody who was not a journalist for a journalism site that doesn't even exist?
Yes, I mean, just first in terms of the release forms, I mean, for them to be able to stand up in court, they have to be easily readable. Otherwise, they wouldn't stand up in court. So, but obviously, Rudy Giuliani signs our release form, which is interesting because in that particular release form, he permitted the use of hidden cameras, which was odd that the president's lawyer didn't thoroughly read a contract. But with him, she was shooting a documentary about how President Trump had been so fantastic with his response to coronavirus that he'd saved 2 million lives. And that was the documentary that she was a reporter for. And so he was speaking to her about what a fantastic job Trump had done in terms of coronavirus.
So in this scene, Borat's daughter, played by Maria Bakalova, she poses as this right-wing journalist. She's interviewing him in a hotel room, and she's behaving very flirtatiously with him. She She's kind of giggling. She puts her hand on his knee a couple of times. And after the interview, she invites him for a drink in the bedroom of this hotel suite. They go in. He says, "You can give me your name and phone number." She takes off his lavalier mic. And for anyone who's ever had a lavalier mic for a broadcast, you usually have to, like, or at least often have to tuck it under your shirt or under your jacket. So she's helping him get off the lavalier mic. As he's sitting on the bed, he leans back a little. She's kind of fidgeting inside his shirt. And he puts his hands down his pants. And he says later, "I was just tucking in my shirt after getting the lavalier off." His hands seem to linger there longer than that. And it's kind of ambiguous what's happening in his pants. So I should just say here, although your daughter is supposed to be 15, I should mention that the actress who plays her is in her 20s, so that you're not...
Yes.
You're not exploiting somebody who is underage here. She is a full adult and knows exactly what she's doing and is a really fantastic improviser and actress.
Oh, she's incredible.
Did the actress, Maria Bakalova, have a safe word in case things got out of hand? A safe word that you would hear?
I cannot remember if there was actually a safe word. We had a plan, which was that if she was scared or if she felt in danger, that she would run to a certain door. We had a security guard who would lead her to safety. But yes, I mean, at one point when Rudy got worried, he basically called the police. And I don't know what he told them, but I think he accused us of having committed a federal crime because the cops came and they raided the room. They searched the room, they actually found some script, and they basically impounded our equipment. So we couldn't film for the, you know, for the next 36 hours. I was advised by my lawyer to leave the state, which I was surprised by because I thought, hold on, has Rudy Giuliani really still got power in New York? Apparently he does. So... Because it's very uncommon for police to raid a room without a warrant.
So you had to evacuate the state. Your crew had to sneak out of the hotel. Do you know if you actually broke any laws? And I don't know how freely you can speak about this.
Yeah, I can. I mean, I know that I did not. We have a fantastic legal team.
You need it.
Yeah, we do. We do. Everything we do is legal. I mean, I'm currently still being sued by Roy Moore. So that these cases take a long time. And, you know, there are standards and practices with any channel that we're with, whether it's HBO or Fox or Amazon. And then there's the law. So, you know, we're very, very careful that we're operating within the standards and practices of the channel and doing stuff that's completely legal.
Well, Sacha Baron Cohen, thank you so much for coming back on our show, and stay safe.
Terry, thank you so much for having me back again.
Sacha Baron Cohen is starring in two movies, the new Borat sequel, Borat's subsequent movie film on Amazon Prime, and The Trial of the Chicago 7 on Netflix. In the new film, Minari, filmmaker Lee Isaac Chung tells the semi-autobiographical story of a family of South Korean immigrants who moved to Arkansas in the 1980s and set up a farm. The movie won both the top jury prize and the top audience prize at last year's Sundance Film Festival. Our critic at large, John Power, says that Minari is a tender film for our untender times.
The history of film is inseparable from immigration. Newcomers to America didn't merely pack the Nickelodeons in movie palaces. They invented Hollywood. Ever since the silent film days, filmmakers have sought to chronicle our vast immigrant experience, from the Sicilian Corleones gaining power through crime in The Godfather, to Pakistani-born Kumail Nanjiani alienating his Muslim parents by falling for a white American girl in The Big Sick. The travails of immigrant life take a quietly beguiling form in Minari, a semi-autobiographical film by Lee Isaac Chung that brims with humor, humanity, and hope. Showing us characters new to American screens, the story centers on a South Korean family named Yi, who hoped to make a go of farming in rural Arkansas during the Reagan years. Minari takes its title from the name of a spicy Asian plant that's known for its hardiness and ability to grow seemingly anywhere. The question is, will the same prove true of the Yi family? The action begins with the four of them arriving in the Ozarks from California. The new farm's dark soil thrills the father, Jacob. That's Stephen Yun, who plans to grow Korean vegetables to sell in the city. In contrast, his wife Monica, played by Hanya Ri, is aghast to be living in an unalluring mobile home out in the boonies. Somewhere in the middle are their kids. Impish 7-year-old David, that's charming Alan Kim, who suffers from a heart condition, and his older sister Anne, played by Noel Kate Cho, who's stuck being the responsible one. Farming proves tricky for Jacob, who takes on a friendly war-damaged farmhand played by Will Patton, yet makes a mess of the irrigation system. Sensing Monica's loneliness, he sends to Korea for her mother, Soon-ja, played by the fantastically good Yoon-ya Jung, whose sly, foul-mouthed brio gives the house and the whole movie a happy boost, even if young David thinks she smells. Watching this freewheeling grandma win over her equally unruly grandson is one of the film's many pleasures. Lee fills Minari with countless details that shimmer with the specificity of the authentically lived. The huge bottles of Mountain Dew that are guzzled like water, grandma's delight in playing cards and watching TV wrestling, the kids writing "Don't fight" on paper airplanes as their folks shout at each other. Monica and Jacob spend their days sorting chickens by sex at the local poultry farm. The male chicks are destroyed. They don't lay eggs. Although Chung doesn't ignore life's catastrophes, he spares us the grinding misery that's a staple of so many immigrant tales. The Yis do struggle financially, but only like millions of others in this country. And even when they encounter racism, like the local kid who asks David why his face is so flat, the two soon become friends. The Yis are Christians, and the local church welcomes its Korean-speaking new parishioners with a warmth that is genuinely Christian. The more painful troubles lie at home, where Monica and Jacob engage in a battle about how to live. Fearing that her husband cares more about the farm than his family, she yearns to return to an orderly sort of life back in California, where she can be close to her culture, attend her familiar Korean church, and they can find secure, steady work sorting chickens. Jacob has lived that life and doesn't want it. At once proud and ambitious, dreamy and angry, all this percolates beneath Yun's good looks. He's prepared to take big risks to be his own boss, even if he makes mistakes doing it. He's becoming more American. Now, I promise that if you see Minari, you'll be happy you did. Yet I don't want to oversell it. It's too gentle, conventional, and modest for that. Yet shining through the film's modesty is Chung's faith that what appears to be a small story can, in human terms, be bigger than a blockbuster. He reminds us that the deepest truths of immigration are found not in statistics or abstractions, but in the countless small stories of individuals and families fighting to find a new place to call home.
John Powers reviewed Minari. It's now showing in select theaters and is available through video on demand services such as Amazon Prime Video and iTunes. My guest, Rosa Brooks, has written a new memoir about her experiences as a reserve police officer with the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. As a reserve police officer, she had the same training as other cops at the police academy and was sent on patrol like other police, but this was a volunteer position in which she was required to work 24 hours a month. When she took on this work, she was in her 40s with two children, a spouse, and a full-time job as a tenured law professor at Georgetown University. She wanted a first-hand understanding of policing because she was disturbed by the statistics on police shootings and by racial disparities in the justice system. Her husband thought she was insane to take on this work, and her mother, writer and left-wing activist Barbara Ehrenreich, was also wildly unenthusiastic. While serving as a police officer from 2016 to 2020, Rosa Brooks founded the Program on Innovative Policing at Georgetown Law School, which launched the Police for Tomorrow Fellowship with Washington, D.C.'s Metropolitan Police Department. Brooks previously worked as a human rights advocate in the U.S. and abroad. During the Obama administration, she established an office on international humanitarian policy at the Defense Department. She studied and wrote about South African police culture during the transition from apartheid and about concentration camps in Bosnia, blood feuds in Kosovo, and child soldiers in Uganda. Her new memoir is called Tangled Up in Blue, Policing in the American City. Rosa Brooks, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry. It's great to be here.
So tell us more about why you wanted to become a cop.
I don't have a good answer to that. I think I must have read too many detective novels during the course of my life. I have two answers to that question. One is one that sounds better, which is that throughout my career, I've worked in, as you said, a human rights activist, et cetera. As a scholar, I've always been fascinated by the relationship between law and violence, and in particular by the stories people tell to explain and justify different kinds of violence. And I've always been interested in policing from that perspective. That's one answer, and it's true. But I think the other answer is I was just curious when I discovered that DC had this program where anyone, even a law professor, could volunteer to be a police officer and go through the police academy and so on. I thought, that is so strange. I can't believe they would give me a badge and a gun and let me be a cop. That's crazy. And I just thought I wanted to do it.
I think when you joined, there were already protests against police departments around the country because of the killing of Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Freddie Gray. So, were you worried about what you were getting yourself into and whether you would be part of what is perceived as the bad guys?
I was, and absolutely the year I applied and during the whole time I was at the police academy, you know, then as now, there were protests in American cities about police violence and race and policing. But I was worried. I was worried about what people would think of it. I was worried that people would think I was becoming a bad guy, because certainly in the communities that I'm part of, there weren't a lot of people saying, oh, well, it's more complicated than that, or, well, the police do good things too. I think my curiosity was stronger than those concerns. And I do believe very deeply that if you want to change something, you have to understand it. And it's very hard to understand something from the outside, you know, that if you want to change policing, you need to understand at a really granular level what the incentives are that police face day to day, what kinds of stories they tell themselves and one another about why they do what they do.
You didn't exactly get a lot of support initially from your family. Your husband, who had been in the military special ops, thought you were insane. Your mother, Barbara Ehrenreich, a lifelong leftist, author of Nickel and Dimed about the difficulty of surviving on many low-paying jobs. As research for that book, she worked at Walmart, she became a waitress, a hotel maid, she cleaned homes, just to see what's it like to live on this kind of wage. And the answer was, not easy. She thought you were crazy, too, and she really opposed it. What kind of conversation did you have with her about that?
We had a lot of pretty tense conversations. She was not only did she think it was not a good idea, she affirmatively thought it was a bad idea. And she had no hesitation about letting me know. I mean, she said, the police are the enemy. You're joining the enemy. And I was upset. You know, we had some real fights about it. And I said, please trust me a little bit, Mom. I'm not going to go do something evil, but trust me. And I think that was a hard sell, because I was not having an easy time articulating why I wanted to do this. And in a sense, I can't blame her from having some skepticism. The family I come from, if I had said from the get-go, I'm infiltrating the police so that I can write an investigative piece revealing the brutality and racism of police, she wouldn't have had any objection. She would have said, be careful. But the idea that I was going in a more open-ended way, and I didn't decide to write this book until after I was already out of the police academy, I think that really bothered her, and it did cause a lot of tensions between us.
And your conclusions, a lot of your conclusions have to do with, it's complicated. It's not... there's a lot of grays. It's not all black and white.
Yeah, this made for the world's worst elevator pitch after I after I did decide to write a book about it. And so then it got much easier to explain to my colleagues what I was doing, right? Because everybody got that. Why are you doing this? Oh, you're writing a book. Oh, I see. And people say, that's so fascinating. You know, you're writing a book. Tell me what your argument is. And I would sort of shrug uncomfortably and say something like, well, you know, it's complicated. That's a terrible elevator pitch, but it's also, you know, it's also true on a deep level. I think that is my takeaway. It's complicated on multiple levels. You know, it's complicated why people go into policing. The day-to-day lived experience of police officers is quite different from the stereotypes, the complicated ways in which police training enables abuses are very real. The degree to which police themselves often feel trapped within the same system that they're working in is very real. The degree to which police officers cannot change many of the worst aspects of policing. You know, there's so many parts of policing that cops can't change and didn't create. There are also things that they did create and can change and should change. But it really is complicated.
Let's talk about some of the contradictions that you were taught. You were taught anytime you go out on a call, you might get killed. So you have to be really careful. You were also told you'd better not do the wrong thing because the police department will not stand by you. You'll get thrown under the bus. The police department didn't teach you that, but everybody else told you that. But the police department did teach you if you do the wrong thing, you're out. Why did that seem contradictory? Why was that hard to process?
I think there was, it just began to dawn on me at the police academy exactly how impossible the job police have is because, as you say, we're told, treat everyone with respect, show empathy, de-escalate situations, stay calm, show compassion. You're also told anybody could kill you at any time, and that in many ways was the single most powerful message, I think, that recruits at the police academy absorbed. And what that meant was you have to constantly be looking at people's hands. You can't let people sit down on the sofa because it's too easy to hide a weapon between the sofa cushions and they could pull it out. You shouldn't interview suspects in the kitchen because there are too many knives available to them. Don't look them in the eye. Look at their hands all the time. Be constantly alert for these sudden motions where somebody's reaching for something. And it's to start with, it's kind of hard to show respect, empathy, and compassion while you're staring at somebody's hands fixedly and refusing to let them sit on their sofa. You know, there's a built-in contradiction right there. And this sense of being constantly under scrutiny by two potentially hostile groups. One, I think police are very keenly aware at the moment that everything they do will be scrutinized by an unforgiving public. Everything, their body-worn camera videos will be out there if anything bad happens. Ordinary people are videotaping them with cell phone videos. And their own department, there was a very clear sense of, you know, if you pose a problem for the department, you will be out, you will be abandoned. I don't mean to say too much, you know, oh, poor, poor police officers, because police officers nonetheless exercise tremendous power over people and sometimes abuse that power egregiously.
When you say you were constantly taught at the police academy that every call could lead to your death, so always be prepared, always be searching for weapons, for any way that somebody can kill you. And that was reinforced through a lot of videos that you saw of police being attacked. Can you describe some of the videos and the impact it had on you as an officer in training?
Yeah, this was part of the unofficial curriculum of the police academy was constantly watching videos that our instructors would refer to as officer safety videos. And essentially what you do is, you know, they'd find some YouTube videos of bad things happening to police officers, and we'd watch them, and the question for us would be, what did this officer do wrong? You know, how could this officer have avoided this? And so we watched these videos of, you know, officers walking up to cars at traffic stops and having somebody jump out of the car and shoot them. You know, we watched these videos of people going to a domestic violence call and just going blithely up to the door and somebody opens the door and shoots them, you know, just and on and on and on. So you get this sort of saturation with these images of police officers getting killed. And the purpose of this was to say, you know, look, how could that officer have approached this vehicle differently? How could the officers have approached the, you know, maybe they shouldn't have stood right in front of the door. You know, they should have stood to the side so that if somebody burst out with a weapon, they wouldn't be right in the line of fire and so on. And up to a point, that's obviously useful. But I think that the overall impact of just video after video of cops getting run over and shot and, you know, dying from inhaling noxious fumes or to traffic, you know, was the sense of constant threat, constant danger. And, you know, you sort of internalize that sense. And it makes a lot of police officers, I think, very jittery and, frankly, very trigger happy. And, you know, thank goodness I never saw during my time with the D.C. police anyone use force in a way that I thought was inappropriate.
What do you think about the calls to defund the police? And what do you think of the wording of defund the police?
I think the wording is unfortunate, but I think that the underlying call to rethink how we allocate resources is absolutely right. And I think the wording puts people off. And, you know, surveys suggest that most members of the public don't like it and don't agree, including in communities of color. You know, and I think the reason for that is that people recognize that although police abuses are real and the systemic racism in the system is real, that crime is also real. And not that many people want to say, oh, I'm cool with no cops, right? You know, the even worse slogan is abolish the police. So I think the rhetoric has not been super helpful. But I think that if you get beyond the word, it's actually something where there's an enormous amount of common ground between police and critics of policing, because the impetus really, I think, is to say, why do we have so much money for enforcement and not very much money for social services? Why do we have so much money for enforcement and not enough money to focus on changing the structural injustices that lead to the racial disparities we see in policing? And I think if you ask the average police officer, if you say to them, we want to defund you, they'll look at you like you're out of your mind and they'll say, look at the car I drive, look at the equipment I have, look how much it's falling apart, look how much I'm operating without adequate resources. And that's true, right? That what we've asked them to do, they already can't do with what they've got. But if you ask them a different kind of question, if you say, do you want to be the social workers, the mediators, the medics, and so on? They'll be like, no, 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 I'm terrible at that. I don't think we should be doing this. I really wish there were other people who could do this because I know we're not doing it right and we shouldn't be doing it at all. You know, that's where there's a lot of common ground. And indeed, if you say to them, do you want to be locking up all these poor people? Most of them will say, my God, no, of course I don't. But that's what you told me to do. And if you don't want me to do that, or you don't want my colleagues to do that, then change the system so you're not telling us to do that anymore.
One of the things people are calling for who are saying defund the police is take some of the money for police and give it to, for instance, social workers, and imagine what it would be like if a social worker went with a police officer to a domestic violence call. Are there times you can think of during your 4 years as a police officer in Washington where you think it would have been helpful to have a social worker with you?
Constantly, probably on three quarters of the calls. You know, that so often the calls we came to, including many of the assaults, many of the domestic violence situations, disorderly conduct situations, involved someone who was mentally ill, or involved people who were having some kind of breakdown in family relationships that didn't necessarily require police, that didn't involve somebody being violent, but simply involved people not having partly not having the ability to figure out how to resolve conflicts, but also sometimes those conflicts were driven by need, you know, that conflicts would be over multiple people in the same house, all of whom were working multiple jobs to hold things together, which would mean that tensions would easily erupt over, well, who's taking too long of a shower when everybody needs to get ready? You know, and so the only thing I would say is that a social worker is not enough, right? I'll give you an example of something. In Washington, D.C., there's an emergency psychiatric clinic where police can take people who are sort of flagrantly crazy and a danger to themselves or others, even involuntarily. You know, so let's say you've got someone who's mentally ill and they're running around and they're threatening people, but you don't think they should be arrested. So you take them off to the emergency psychiatric clinic, where the odds are they'll be given a dose of meds and they'll be back out again in the morning. So having a social worker or a psychiatrist who checks in doesn't get you far enough, because the underlying problem there is that there's nowhere for them to go. They'll end up back out on the street the next day threatening people because we don't have an adequate mental health system. We don't have an adequate system of providing shelter for people who lack it. And so social workers who would go to some calls would be a good start, but it's not nearly enough.
Rosa Brooks, thank you so much for talking with us. And I'm really glad that you became a reserve police officer so that you could think through all of this and write a book about it.
Terry, thank you so much for having me on.
Rosa Brooks is a law professor at Georgetown University and a former reserve police officer with the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. Her new memoir is called Tangled Up in Blue, Policing the American City.